WGN.
Morning, girl. How'd you sleep last night? You're several ages older now. Your eyes have started showing how the little girl's growing now. Morning, girl. Was that you last night? Crying on the radio, begging for a way to go, to go back where love wasn't jumbled so. Oh no, things are different now.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal on WGN 720. We got in studio our friend John Langford, who called me about a month ago and said he wanted to bring in Norbert Putnam from the King of Nashville Pop. I mean, you wrote this book, Volume 1, Music Lessons, a musical memoir. It's just so deep, all the people you worked with, you know. I mean, it's right here, Elvis Presley, Ray Charles, the Beatles. We're going to talk about Buffett.
I never met any of those people. I'm here to confess. Okay?
But I'm going to back into this with a guilty pleasure of that 1969 hit. It's in your book. Talk about the Neon Philharmonic.
The Neon Philharmonic. Okay, the Beatles have done Sgt. Pepper and it's symphonic and it's all kinds of stuff. And there's this local guy, Tupper Saucy, very well educated young pianist, studied with Oscar Peterson when he was a teenager, and he becomes a great orchestrator arranger. He's writing. He wrote a concerto that the Nashville Symphony did, and my friend Bill Purcell, the great pianist, played it, and. And so I get a call one day that Tupper has been signed to do what supposedly is going to be a very commercial record. And my friend Don Gant, who was he was a concertmaster of his junior symphony, who can sight read anything, can sing these difficult melodies, okay? And so I show up with Jerry Carrigan, and Tupper hands me a rhythm part. He said, look, play anything you want. Just try to play off the wall and make it really busy. Okay, which is the nicest thing you could ever say to a bass player, all right? You know? I mean, it's basically an invitation to make a fool of yourself. But the record came out, and people loved it, didn't they?
Yeah, and Nashville
go right.
Nashville Symphony played on it.
Well, it was actually most of the guys were studio guys.
Okay,
but there were a few symphonic. You know, the Nashville Symphony in those days wasn't very good. It was an amateur orchestra. And the string players we had in Nashville all came from major symphonies, and they only worked the record dates, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was it's a heck of a chart, isn't it?
Yeah, it's wild. And it's in the book, but real briefly, talk about what happened to Tupper. I mean, the tax thing. I mean, it's a fascinating music story.
Well, Tupper was always sort
it's of, lesson number 13, yeah,
yes,
in your book.
Yes,
yeah.
And you understand.
I mean, look at this. I mean, like a Richard Strauss arrangement of Rocky Top played by the Vienna Symphony after one too many stems of good champagne.
Did I say that?
Great writing.
I
put it in yellow. I put it in yellow there. Yeah.
I must have been having one too many stems myself. You know?
But Tupper, what happened after he had this hit?
Well, we're supposed to do another record, okay? And we did, and. I think they were hesitant to put it out because it got even more symphonic. It got even more Stravinsky. There was more dissonance. Richard Strauss would have been, you know, he would have been very pleased with Tupper. You know, it was like he was playing B major chords against a C triad. And
yeah.
Wow. But Tupper, the second record didn't succeed, and so Tupper goes into the insurance, not insurance. He went into the advertising business. And he invented the Purity Cow for Purity Milk. And he won the advertising award that year, you know. And then he got bored with that, and his wife divorced him. And I meet him. He's living in an apartment that's basically an apartment complex for men who've been divorced. and I said, Tupper, what are you doing? He says, I'm painting watercolor pictures of brown paper bags. And...
Have you done?
And so, just like you would carry your sandwiches in if you worked, you know, down at the mill or something, okay? And he had four or five of them done, and I said, "Does anybody buy this?" He goes, "All the rich people in Bellmead are paying me $2,000 or $3,000 for one of these, and I can knock it out in an hour." You see? But he gets into a little bit of trouble. He moves over to the mountain area near Suwanee, Tennessee. And there's a great university there. And I sort of lose touch of him. But he'd been visiting, who was the guy who supposedly shot Martin Luther King?
Oh, you were talking James Earl Ray?
Yeah. So he's hanging out with, he goes to the prison and is talking to him. And they're going to write the truth about that, okay, right? But I don't think that
Tupper and James Earl Ray are going to
do it.
Yeah,
right. They've got to figure out who done it, right? Yeah. Who actually done it, you know. And then he starts... he's filing his income tax, and he starts researching our currency. And sure enough, we don't have enough sterling or gold to back our currency. And so instead of paying his taxes, he simply writes on there, if I had currency that had value, I would pay you, but I don't, so I'm not paying you, right?
Well, like our president is doing.
Exactly. but it's never a good idea to screw around with the federal government.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they brought him to trial. And they sentenced him to 2 years in federal prison, okay? And he was to appear in Atlanta at 9 o'clock in the morning on a certain day.
It's a great story.
And when the guards came out at 9 o'clock, there was a note from Tupper. "I was here at 8:45. Where were you?" And he went on the lam, okay? Yeah. And we would get together in Nashville and try to figure out, where is Tupper? You know, we said, well, he loved Gauguin. And we figured he's probably on a luthra. He loved a luthra. He's probably playing old neon philharmonic tunes in a bar with pictures, poorly painted pictures of Gauguin, Gauguin style. More than 3 or 4 years go by, and I was living in Mississippi, and the news travels slow to Mississippi, if at all.
Yeah.
Okay, and I got a phone call. "Can I come to Nashville to celebrate the fact Tupper's been released from prison?" I didn't even know he'd been caught, okay? He was brilliant. He went to a town and took an assumed name in a city where everyone had an assumed name. Los Angeles, California, okay? He was another actor in Los Angeles. And the FBI found him, and they locked him up, and he found God, okay?
Okay.
And he led services, and he gets out. And so I went up to Nashville, and there he was. You know, he was sitting there, and Ray Stevens and I sort of hung late after the party was over, and he played a couple of piano pieces for us. You know, and I said, "Tupper, why don't we put the Neon Philharmonic together, and we'll go do symphony gigs everywhere?" Okay, he goes, "Wow, that's a great idea. Would you play bass?" I said, "Well, I'll try. I hadn't played bass in a long time." I said, "I can probably do those parts, you know." And I called him one day. I was going to Nashville. And he said, "Come by and see me." And I got up there and got busy and didn't have time to go see him. And the next week, the newspaper, Tupper Saucy, died of a heart attack.
Oh, wow.
And I felt like it was my fault. I should have gone to see him, you know.
Wow.
But
I didn't know it played out like that.
Yeah, but he was a great genius.
What was the instrument you played, Norbert, on those records? Isn't there some keyboard, some weird keyboard you play?
No, I played bass on the Neon Philharmonic stuff.
I heard there was what instrument did they use? Didn't they use some?
Well, Tupper played all the keyboards, and we used an electronic clavin harpsichord.
That's right, electronic harpsichord. All right, I saw you a film of you playing one of them. Though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would do it if we couldn't find anybody. Okay.
But I'm glad we played Morning Girl. That's such a great story. It's in Music Lessons, a musical memoir. How can people find the book? Then I want to get to Johnny here.
Well, you know, we're guarding them, all the copies closely. We're not letting them out. Well, you go to NorbertPutnam.com, but it's now available on Amazon.
Okay.
And for my friends in Europe, we're looking for a distributor for Europe. It costs a ton of money to mail a book to Europe, you know. So I published it myself because
it's really good.
Well, I'm glad you like it. The publisher said nobody knows who you are, and nobody will buy this book. Okay, And I thought, well, that seemed like a challenge. You know what I'm saying?
That's a morale builder.
It was sort of like
a record company saying that.
Yeah, every time I take an act to the record company, they go, are you crazy? Nobody buys this guy. You know,
So, John Lankford, now I'm guessing, but in your own words, did you come through all this with the Nashville Cats exhibit, or tell you how you crossed paths with Norbert?
I got asked by the Country Music Hall of Fame to do some illustration work, and I thought that was it. I'd do a painting, send it to them, and that would be the end of it. But they were like very keen that I came down.
Yeah.
And I went down and discussed like the catalogue and the exhibition plan with them. It's a really amazing scholarly exhibition, which kind of writes a few, you know, the perceived myth of Nashville in the 60s was the hippies came on and they turned the straits on. You know?
Yeah,
and
right.
It was really boring and conservative, and then the hippies turned up, and then everybody had this big party. What was going on really was people like Norbert were down there, and Norbert came from Muscle Shoals, and Norbert was playing like Ray Charles, James Brown type music. Then when he ended up in Nashville, you know, it was country. You said this morning, I heard you talking on the radio, another radio station this morning, you said that was about the only thing you didn't really know how to play was country music. But
yeah,
well, that's true. In Alabama, we never, the teenagers, we listened to Ray Charles, James Brown was king, okay?
Yeah.
So anyway, we ended up, he'd moved back to Florence, so we were in the same hotel. There was a nice restaurant and a nice bar in the hotel. So we kind of bonded, and then Norbert played bass for me in the Country Music Hall of Fame for like the big opening gig.
Right.
And I had my super group was Charlie McCoy, Matt Gaydon, Wayne Moss, Norbert Putnam, David Briggs, Lloyd Green. And I'm singing two Johnny Cash songs, and it was a, you know, I did my best, but I was kind of completely terrified because I had this, you know, super group behind me. And then,
I thought you did great.
I did all right. Yeah. But then Norbert came up to me afterwards and he said, you should come down to Muscle Shoals and make a record an album. I'm like, all right. He said, no, I think you said, you sing like a pirate. You should come down to Muscle Shoals. I said, all right. And then I saw him 6 months later, and he said the same thing. I thought he wouldn't remember where I was, and he went, hey, why don't you haven't been down to Muscle Shoals, come down. And then Mark Garino, who's a writer in town, was with me, and he said, I'm going to make sure you do that. So then we went away. Bethany Thomas was here tonight, and Tony Newsom had been working with me with Skull Orchard, and we got John Szymanski, and then we kind of, I had these ideas about what sort of album would I make in Muscle Shoals, and I'd want to do something that dealt with that kind of the politics, the history of the South. And,
so we're going to take a break, but so you guys are doing a record together then?
We've done it.
You've done it. And when will it be out?
It's out in September.
Out in
September. Norbert produced it.
And Norbert
put a band together in Muscle Shoals.
And it'll be out on Bloodshot.
Bloodshot, right.
And can you play a song from it after the break?
We can play your song. And we have a CD. You could actually hear the actual record if you want.
Okay, we'll take a break on Nocturnal Journal after this.
Storm on the ocean, storm on the ocean, moving his old way. It's $95 or $96 right here in an envelope for you.
Don't be putting that overcoat on. We want another number. We want another song. I thought he was dead. He sang Storm on the Ocean. Storm on the Ocean. Moving his old way.
It's getting so you can't afford to die.
He sang Storm.
Storm on the ocean,
moving his own way. You find him sitting by the back door, listening to the radio. Long strides down the railroad track, never on the road, you'd give anything away. He gave away everything. He might wait till you offer to pay, then he'd just give it away.
I thought he was dead. But he sang Storm on the Ocean. Storm on the Ocean. Moving his old way. It's getting so you can't afford to die. Yeah, he sang Storm on the Ocean. Old way.
Except for the mistakes.
You passed the audition, Norbert.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. Norbert Putnam and John Lankford. And introduce the band, John.
It's John Szymanski on guitar and Bethany Thomas on vocals. And that's the first time Norbert's actually played an instrument.
Well, so, thank you. Thank you for coming in. Tell us about that.
Dust on his bass guitar when he got it out of the case. Dust on it. Moths flew out.
Now, come on now. This is kind of a nice instrument, you know?
Tell us about that song.
That was one of the first songs I wrote. I was down in Nashville, spending quite a lot of time down there because I was artist in residence at the Country Music Hall of Fame, and I worked at Hatch Showprint and produced artwork for the exhibit. And we even did illustrations for lyrics of Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan kind of semi-commissioned us to do lyrics of a big letterpress poster, the lyrics of North Governor North Country,
right,
which he sang with Cash. And I had a lot of time off while I was doing all that, and mostly I was sitting in my friend Grant's bedroom, and he's got loads of books about, you know, the history of music, so and the South, and I just started writing stuff like that. That's our secular gospel song.
Well, and if you come to Nashville, you have to see John's work.
Yeah. Yeah.
On this Nashville Cat exhibit.
Yeah.
I mean, he brought it to life, and it's brilliant, brilliant stuff.
Yeah, we did a thing on it.
It's up till December. They extended it.
I was telling Dan, our producer, we could have done the whole 2 hours with you. I have so many questions, but tell us about Quadrophonic Studios with David Briggs and stuff, and what that was about, and how that was different from, actually, to be specific, how that was different from what was going on.
Well, first of all, everything that Dave and I ever succeeded with was by accident. We were trying to do something else, you see, and by 1970, when we construct the studio, well, we're now among the top 4 or 5 players on our instruments. We're playing 600 record dates a year. That's a lot of work. Every day I had a 10-to-1 with an artist, grab a sandwich, a 2-to-5 with another.
Hey, you're talking the book, like you'd start the day with Loretta Lynn, and then...
Well,
yeah.
And you were likely to work with Loretta Lynn, Tony Joe White, Al Hurt,
yeah,
or Henry Mancini, or J.J. Cale. It was kind of fun as a player because you got to change hats every 3 hours and become a different kind of player, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But David and I decided that we didn't want to grow old in the studios, okay? Because I would leave home at 9 in the morning and either come home at 10 in the evening or 2 a.m. And it played havoc with my wife and my kids, you know? And so we would have dinner on Saturday night, and David said, you know, if we could write 2 hit songs a year, we could make as much money as we make as players. And I said, anybody can write this stuff, you know? These songs are really silly songs. And so David said, let's buy a little building, and we'll put a little demo studio in here, and you and I will write hit songs. Capital idea. So we bought this 1905 building, and it was a lovely old building.
What part of Nashville was it? I know Nashville fairly well.
Well, it's right over there near Vanderbilt on Grand Avenue, 2 blocks literally from RCA Studio A, okay, you know. And so we're going to become famous songwriters. We can do this. We can get a rhyming dictionary like everyone else, see? And Elliot Mazur, who was a successful New York producer, comes down. He was bringing Linda Ronstadt. Elliot produced a long, long time, and I was the arranger on that, okay? And I did play the harpsichord because we couldn't get anyone else. But Elliot comes in. He goes, I love this studio, this old house. And the front parlor, there was a fireplace, and there were pocket doors going into what would have been the dining area. And a little kitchen area in back, we decided that we would put the drums in there and have a totally isolated drum booth. I think we were the first studio in Nashville to ever do that, you know. And Elliot said, why don't you put in modern equipment, 16-track, and I'll bring all my acts here. And we said, You would? and he said, I'm getting ready to do Neil Young, and I'm doing Linda Ronstadt. And so we had a meeting, and he sort of came in as a one-third partner, and we equipped it as a modern studio, right? But there was a guy who was helping construct the control room. Oh, we put it on the front porch. Okay. And you look through the bay window in the park. Well, we took that out and put in triple pane glass, you know. But there was this carpenter guy who kept bugging us and telling us. He said, you know, I'm really down here from Cincinnati trying to be a songwriter. And are you guys going to have a publishing company? And we're saying, well, yeah, but we're going to be the only two writers, you see. And he said, well, would you listen to one of my songs? And we said, well, if you finish the control room, you know. And so, at last it's all completed. And David and I are upstairs one day, and my secretary buzzes me and said, you remember Troy who worked in the carpenter business? I said, well, you promised him you'd listen for a song. I was sending him up. I said, now, David, this guy's going to be terrible, but let's let him down easy, right? And Troy Seals comes up.
Oh, okay.
And he opens his guitar case, and he tunes his guitar flawlessly. The guy can actually tune a guitar. Very few people can tune a guitar, you know. Chet said he was 30 years old before he learned to tune his guitar. But then he hands us a lyric sheet, and he starts singing. He's got a great voice. And I'm reading the lyric. It's a great lyric, right? Yeah. And he does two or three of these. And we said, well, Troy, go downstairs. I said, David, we will never be able to write as good as this guy.
Okay, hold that thought. We're going to take a break with David Jennings of the News, and we're going to come back with Norbert Putnam and John Langford and some more music after this.
Everybody's gone away. Said they're moving to L.A. There's not a soul I know around. Everybody's leaving town. Some caught a freight, some caught a plane. Find the sunshine, leave the rain. They say this town will waste your time. I guess they're right, it wasted mine. Some gotta win, some gotta lose. Good time Charlie's got the blues. Good time Charlie's got the blues. My heart keeps telling me you're not a kid at 33. You play around, you lose your wife. You play too long, you lose your life. Some gotta win, some gotta lose. Good time Charlie's got the blues. Good time Charlie's got the blues. Good time Charlie's got the blues.
Welcome back to Nocturnal Journal. Bass player Norbert Putnam, Johnny Langford, and thanks so much for coming down. When was the last time you, Norbert, when was the last time you played that song?
40-something years ago.
And who was it with?
Some guy named Presley.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Is that part of the new, are you doing that on the new record?
No, I just love that song, but it's on the Elvis Stax album.
Yeah.
Which Norbert's on a lot of those tracks.
Yeah, and you'd think I would have remembered it. It's only been 47 years. Yeah.
That was, yeah. Gosh, there's so much. I do want to touch on the Stax stuff, but we were on Quadrophonics. So the stuff I'd read, and actually read some of this at the exhibit when I went down there, Quadrophonic, correct me if I'm wrong, I think a little bit of it is in the book too. It was a little more wide open. People could come in and drink for free. Jerry Jeff Walker, Guy Clark hang around there. Did Buffett come through there? I mean, what was the atmosphere like?
Well, Bob Beckham ran the most successful publishing company in town, and he had free beer every day from 5 to 6. and so all the other writers from the other publishers would go over there, and they all say, Bob's a great guy. So David and I, we said, well, so how do we beat Beckham? Well, we had a fully stocked bar at Quad, okay? Uh-huh. You could walk in, go upstairs, and there's like 40 bottles up there. So everyone was coming to drink with us, and then they wanted to record with us, and so it all got back to alcohol again, didn't it, you see? But we got lucky, you know. So Elliot's bringing some acts, but Joan Baez called me up one day. I'd introduced Chris Christopherson to her, and she said, Norbert, I'm coming to Nashville to do another record, and it's going to be a double record set, and I want you to get some younger players from Memphis and Muscle Shoals, because I'm doing favorite songs by favorite writers. You know, she did a Stevie Wonder song, a Paul McCartney song, and I said, well, will Maynard Solomon produce, who owned Vanguard? And she said, no, Chris is going to produce. And I knew Chris to be a little shy around players, you know. And I said, great. And so I book a great band, and we're going to do it at my studio. First big act to come to Quad, you see. And I go down there on the Monday. We're going to do 2 to 5, 6 to 9, 10 to 1 a.m., 15 sessions in 5 days, 24 sides. Charlie McCoy said, what are we going to do with all the downtime? Because we can do that in 2 days, you know. But so I go down there, and Chris is back by the drink machine, and he's wedged into the corner, and he'd had a few cocktails. He had a lot to drink, okay? And I went back there, and I said, are you okay? I'm not okay. I said, well, now I'm thinking, will we have to cancel all these sessions? These guys will kill me if I cancel entirely. I said, look, let me tell you how you produce. You go into the control room, and you drink a beer, and you don't say anything. We'll make you a great record, okay? Just don't say anything, right? Which is still good advice to
That's
young
what Ken
producers.
Nelson always said on those Haggard and
exactly.
Buck Owens. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. And he goes, no, he says, I've been talking to Joni. We think you should produce the record. I went upstairs and she was in the office. I said, John, have you seen Chris? Norbert, Chris is drunk. You think you could help me make this record? We're starting in 10 minutes. Yes, let's do it. And I plugged my bass in the desk so I could listen and play. I often thought she might have chosen Briggs if we could have gotten the grand piano in the control room. Uh-huh, uh-huh. And we got lucky on Wednesday, I think it was Wednesday night of that week, we get to Robbie Robertson's the night they drove Old Dixie down, you know. And truthfully, I didn't have to say anything to the band because Joni played that intro lick on the guitar. Yeah. And she did this live with the band and did the vocal live, you know. And we did it about three, four takes. We had it. And she said, what are you hearing on the chorus? And I said, I'd like to hear basically a lot of people singing like you would have at a concert, almost in unison on that, you know. Where will we get people like that? Well, out in the hall was all of these drunks with their girlfriends, okay? And some of them were Nashville's greatest. Mickey Newberry was out there and Dave Loggins.
Was Buffett? I read Buffett was one.
Buffett, I think, could have been. Yeah. I know he was showing up during the week with the free booze upstairs. They would go up there and get drinks and come down and sit on the floor and pass guitars around playing their latest songs, you know. So we got all the girlfriends and the drunks in there, and Joni went out and stood closest to the mic. She could get it in tune. And of course, we put Chris and Donnie Fritz in the back, and we did it once in stereo, and it still wasn't powerful enough. So we did it again, and it still wasn't powerful.
You did the same thing on my album.
Well, I tried, you know.
You did. It was exactly the same thing, except we didn't have any drunks.
Well, see,
you had dogs. You brought your dogs in.
He's finding out. I did the same thing on every record I ever made, you see. but to make a long story short, the next week I was doing some serious singing. Right? The Holiday Sisters ran, so I stacked them in there, and it got a little more in tune. But I often thought that the chorus was one of the reasons that record really sounded
right.
So good.
Yeah, that's a great story. How did Goodman find you there? You did the first Steve Goodman record, yeah. which is legendary here.
Well, it was Chris again.
Yeah.
Chris called me. He'd been here in Chicago with Ahmet Erdogan and had gone to hear John Prine and Steve Goodman, two local guys.
Yeah.
And I think he said he signed both of them.
Right.
Okay. And he asked Chris if he wanted to produce one. He said, I'd like to do Steve Goodman. And Chris calls me. He said, you want to do it with me? You know. And so I said, is this guy any good? Oh, Norbert, wait till you hear the songs. And he came down, and we did The City in the New Orleans. And everybody fell in love with Steve. He was the sweetest guy you ever met. You know?
What did you think when you heard City in New Orleans?
Oh, I loved the fact it was such an unusual song.
Uh-huh.
You know, it sort of reminded me of, you know, Dave Loggins, we did Please Come to Boston. What an unusual song that was, where he's in a different town in every verse, you know?
Yeah.
And here's a song about a train, you know, that's flowing through the woody. It was almost like something from the 1920s.
You're talking about place and location. Your book brings up a really good point. I was telling you during the break about when you worked with Dan Fogelberg, you kind of told him, you know, he loved the mountains, so you wanted to record in Colorado.
Yeah.
You kind of told Buffett, if you're writing about the sea, get by the water. Elaborate on that. How sense of place is so important when you're recording.
Well, the modern recording studio is the most bizarre place in the world to put an artist. It's big and cavernous, and it's daunting. You walk in there, and it doesn't feel like a concert hall. It doesn't feel like a club, you know. And nowadays, they put people in different rooms, you know.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to get... Dan was loved the mountains, and it turned out the Caribou Ranch was only 10 miles away. And when he came down off his mountain, we could go straight into the studio, and it didn't break anything about his heart and soul of the mountains. He was better there than he was at Quadrophonic or any other studio. And so I get Buffett, and what do you do with Jimmy Buffett? All the songs are about the ocean. And I said, we're going to the ocean. And he said, but you've got the greatest studio in the world here. I said, but we don't have salt air. And Jimmy, I said, I want to do you on location. David Lean made movies on location for a reason, didn't he? You know, he didn't do Dr. Zhivago and Los Angeles.
Buffett of Arabia.
Yeah. And so I guess I stole a little bit from David Lean. And I get Buffett down to Florida. We run a big mansion on the bay. We got 24 people sleeping in the hall, okay? And we have very little money on that first record. But Jimmy has just made enough money on Come Monday to buy a used Charlie catch. And he brings that over. It's a 32-footer. And so I said, Jimmy, we will work every day from 11 to 5. And then we'll go down and take the boat out, crank up the diesel, pull her into the wind, and check the day's work and see if we're getting any of this ocean island stuff.
You know? Really?
Yeah. And it prompted Buffett, after about 3-4 days, one morning we were at breakfast, he says, I've started a new song. And I said, really? We had some good songs on the record already. I said, well, what are you going to call it? I think I'm going to call it Margaritaville, which is another way to say Key West. I'm living in Key West. It's sort of like a day and a night and a morning of my life in Key West. Well, I hated the title, Margaritaville, okay? Ville was a cliche thing at the time. You know, the Detroit studio was called Hitsville.
Right.
Mancini wrote a ballad called Dreamsville, you know? I'm thinking, this is not going to be very good. I was wrong. Yeah. As a matter of fact, if you read my book, I was wrong a lot of the time, wasn't I? You know, my first editor said, are you sure you want to put this book out? You're the biggest fool in the room, you know? But when Buffett brought that song in and played it for us, we all knew it was a hit.
Yeah. And you did several albums with him, right? Like 3 or 4?
I did the next 6 albums.
6 albums, yeah.
Until we lost our good luck charm.
But he's always had a great... We've had some of the band members on here. I know you know Utley. Utley's great, yeah.
Well, I have to tell you, Utley was a major part of those records.
Yeah.
And we bring him in. You know, he wasn't playing in Jimmy's band at that point. And I brought in Kenny Buntry, the great
drummer. Oh, yeah.
And he saved Margaritaville.
Yeah, you know? I read that in the book. Yeah. And some about Buffett, the original drummer. I mean, Buffett's pretty aggressive with him, right? He said,
Well, Jimmy was a hell of a band leader.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
He had him by the throat. What are you trying to do, ruin my career?
Yeah. musically, though, how did Buntry change the record?
The drummer who played with Jimmy, they'd rehearsed all the songs. And they really played well when they got to the studio. But now we have a new song. And we've got to play it from scratch. And the drummer was just trying to figure out what to do. And I realized everyone else had it after two or three takes except the drummer.
Uh-huh.
And I said, Jimmy, he's your guy. I know you can handle him with kid gloves, you know. And he said, so you want to put Buntry in? I said, yeah. And so he calls the drummer out in the hall. He grabbed him by the neck. What are you trying to do? Ruin my career? And he's choking the guy. And I'm thinking, I should have spoken to him. You know?
Okay.
And so, this is the sort of stuff that people like about the book, I think.
Oh, yeah.
A little insight.
It's really, really, really.
The throttling.
Yeah. A hell of a band leader, Jimmy Buffett. That's what he was.
Yeah. Okay, we got to take a break. You're going to come back on another song?
Yeah.
We have time left. So don't go away on Nocturnal Journal.
Just like our shack, we worked in the fields together, and we learned to count on each other. 'Cause when you live off the land, you don't have time to think about another man's color.
Tony Joe White.
The great Tony
Didn't
Joe.
Didn't get to the tough political punchline.
Pope Salad Annie.
So, tell us about that song. Tony Joe White.
Well, Norbert recorded that in 1966, isn't that right?
Was that 50 years ago? Is that it's 100 years ago.
You told me you recorded that over 100 years ago.
Well, Tony Joe comes in, and he had a song called Poke Salad Annie, and that was the hit, you know. As a matter of fact, It was number one in France for over a year because the French couldn't figure out what he was saying.
Yeah,
don't you think? I don't know. You shouldn't ask me these questions. You know? I was just a bass player. Okay.
That's a fantastic album, though.
I think
the album's called Black and White, and it was kind of one of the things I was thinking about when I went down, because that time in Muscle Shoals it's this blurry time, and between, you know, racially, musically, it's not what we had after that, and after like the assassination of Martin Luther King, when you have like white music, black music, and there's a kind of much more fluid period.
That, you know, I was thinking, I've known you for a long time, and what's it been like for you to take this journey through American music? Is it growing up as a music as a player and a musician, the chance to meet these people and work with these people, the Charlie McCoys, Norbert, what's it done for you? How's it influenced your music?
I don't know. It's just been great fun. Yeah. Anyone from Britain that grew up, you know, I mean, I look back at photos of when I was at college and it's all in black and white and it's raining and everything's on strike and, you know, the garbage isn't being picked up and the power stations are shut down 3 days a week and things like that. And, you know, it's just, America was just this place. You kind of, everything was in Technicolor, and you know, I loved American movies, I loved westerns,
I loved, you know, rock and roll music. I was excited by it. And to come here, you know, one of my big disappointments was coming here and finding that they'd kind of done away with most of the great cultural events of the 20th century, like Hank Williams and Johnny Cash. People like that were, Johnny Cash told me he wasn't, couldn't get on the radio. You know, George Jones wasn't on the radio, Merle Haggard, all these giants that I loved. All this music had been kind of swept away, and they put a shopping mall on top of it and were making this horrible music I didn't like. So I just got more and more into digging, you know. I was looking for country music all over America, and I found it down by the Graham bus station here with the Sundowners.
Sundowners, yeah.
It's been great. But then, I've been very critical of Nashville, and it was really nice the people at the Country Music Hall of Fame, rather than resenting me for that, had actually, you know, actually rewarded me. And meeting Norbert was the icing on the cake, really. And going to Muscle Shoals was just a fantastic experience for all of us. We went the day after the election. It was kind of...
Yeah,
it was kind of terrible. We thought we'd be, you know, everyone's going to be driving around in pickup trucks with Confederate flags, and actually Norbert just took us to a rather nice wine bar where everybody agreed with us that Trump was awful.
It's over for the old South. It's gone.
But Norbert, I mean, that song you just did, there's such a texture of place, and such, again, we always talk about that. And do you, you know, throughout your career, do we still have that? Do we still have a feeling of place in music, or are things becoming so homogenized?
Well, all of those records, and when I was a player, were made with a live band in a room playing to the emotion of the vocalist. Our job was to accompany a singer. And we had to be able to change hats. The musicians were chameleon-like. They could play country, they could play folk, they could play rock. They could read music with Henry Mancini and Al Hurt. And they were capable of so much, you know. And... today, you take a hit record by Katy Perry, Taylor Swift. They're made by a guy over in Sweden sitting in a room with his keyboards and his samples. And he creates a whole track. He writes the song. He brings them in, teaches them the harmony. And so the emotion. See, the great thing about us, we had six or seven geniuses in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And you had Charlie McCoy and Mike Utley and Wayne Moss, and any one of them was likely to say, I've got a great thing for the intro. And then everyone gets excited, you see. But when you have one guy sitting there, six minds are better than one when it comes to music. And now that, I think that's the thing that's missing. And the fact, he doesn't make the track to the vocal, he now fits the vocal over his track. So the dynamics are gone.
One thing I've found about playing music over the years, you know, in different situations, is that it's a naturally collaborative experience, and it is what Norbert said, six minds are better. You know, the Mekons, eight minds are better. You know, we've been doing that for so long, just fluid and, you know, into no egos and just letting whoever has the best idea sort of take over.
This has been a real, real treat. This is right up my alley. So thank you. Thanks for putting this together. You got to come back. When's the record come out? November?
September, then we're going to be doing some touring. But I think I've persuaded Norbert to play bass on some gigs. So,
but we're going to rehearse next time, aren't we?
I thought you didn't need to rehearse if you have a chart.
I'm not used to playing bad notes, you know.
But there's so much more I didn't get to. I mean, we didn't even talk about Elvis and all that. Norbert Putnam, Volume 1, Music Lessons, a Musical Memoir. So is there going to be a Volume 2?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I think I've got 12 stories outlined for Volume 2.
It's really a great book. How can people find it? One more time.
Well, Amazon is the easiest place to get it. But you go to norbertputnam.com. It's a little faster than Amazon.
Okay. So, thanks so much. It was great meeting you. Johnny Langford.
Thank you very much, Dave.
And it'll be out. Does the record have a title?
Yeah, it's called John Langford's Four Lost Souls.
Okay.
A self-titled. That's the band. And Bethany Thomas is here tonight as one of the Four Lost Souls.
Thanks for
coming
in.
As is John Szymanski.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming in.